Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Eleanor Klibanoff. Lead poisoning may seem to be an issue of the past, but earlier this year, residents of Flint, Michigan were reminded just how common and dangerous lead still is. The city switched water supplies, causing the lead pipes to leach toxins into the water. Huge numbers of children have been diagnosed with lead poisoning, which can cause developmental delays and medical complications. But Flint isn't the only city in the country that has lead infrastructure. My colleagues at Keystone Crossroads have been covering the potential lead hazards in Pennsylvania, where lead paint is prevalent and lead pipes were once a requirement in some cities. Later, Irina Zhurov and I will discuss those lead sources. But first, Keystone Crossroads reporter Mariel Segura talks with us about the history of lead and how those dangers were first discovered. Mariel, we've been using lead for a really long time, right?
So the Romans used lead in their pipes and in makeup and for a lot of other things. And even at the time, people knew that lead might be poisonous, but they didn't really do much about it. Some people even attribute the decline of the Roman Empire to lead poisoning, although people attribute the decline of the Roman Empire to a lot of things, so who knows. But lead was used a lot at the times of the Romans and in antiquity. It wasn't used as much in between that and the Industrial Revolution. But with the start of the Industrial Revolution, you started to see lead used in pipes and in gasoline and in paint. So suddenly it was everywhere.
Back then, were people aware of the dangers associated with lead?
It was mostly considered to be an occupational hazard. So people knew it was toxic, but they thought it was really toxic to the workers who made those products and not to the end consumers. Over time, they started to realize that it had an effect on people. And, you know, people were getting poisoned. They were getting sick from it, having seizures, going into comas and dying from the lead paint in their homes, from being poisoned through lead pipes. But a lot of doctors didn't realize that that's what the problem was. They just attributed their deaths to other diseases.
So what effect does lead have on children?
So yeah, for a long time, scientists were only paying attention to the effect that lead had on adults. They were using a different barometer. But it actually, we now know that lead has an even more severe effect on children. So both adults and children can be poisoned by lead, and exposure to very high levels can cause vomiting, seizures, coma, and sometimes death. And for adults, there are other side effects of lower level lead exposure, you know, immune system suppression and renal failure, hypertension, not good things. But young children, especially toddlers who've been exposed to lead, also suffer from drops in IQ, from behavioral problems, from learning disabilities. And a lot of scientists now think that those health effects are permanent. The reason that young children are affected in this way is that, well, number one, particularly between the ages of 1 and 2, young children absorb more lead through their intestines than an adult would. And also their blood-brain barrier, the barrier that keeps toxins in the blood from getting into the brain, is still developing. So that makes it easier for lead to pass through. And children at that age love to put everything in their mouths, including lead paint chips. And, you know, lead tastes sweet, so the kids keep going back for more. So the kids not only, you know, when they do have lead in their blood, absorb more of it, but they're also more likely to ingest lead in the first place.
Who figured that out, the connection between lead and children?
There were some researchers in the early 20th century who started to look at the effects that lead had on children. But for the most part, scientists thought that if a kid was poisoned by lead, they would either get sick and die, or, you know, if they survived it, they would be fine in the long term. And then researchers started to realize that wasn't the case. Some doctors started noticing changes in the kids that they treated who were chronically exposed to lead and chronically coming into the emergency room with high levels of lead in their blood, and then they had to get it, take medicine to fix the problem. They started noticing that those kids were a little delayed developmentally. So one person who sticks out, there were a ton of researchers who started to look at this, but one guy who sticks out is Dr. Herbert Needleman. He did research starting in really the 1970s, that laid the foundation for the federal ban on lead in gasoline and for much of the research on lead that came after.
So what sort of research was he doing?
First of all, he took an interest in lead poisoning as a pediatrician at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and he saw a lot of kids come in with symptoms of lead poisoning, and he started to realize that these kids might have other symptoms that they didn't really understand or that hadn't been tied yet to lead poisoning. Basically, at the time, the only way that they could measure your level of lead in your blood was through a blood test, and the blood test didn't tell you how much lead you'd been exposed to over time. It kind of told you how much lead was in your blood at the moment. So he had an idea to look at children's baby teeth. They knew that lead was concentrated in a person's bones. And so they thought, you know, it'd be really hard to take a piece of a child's leg bone out or arm bone. But baby teeth, they thought, would have similar concentrations and they fall out naturally. And so they did something called the Tooth Fairy Project. He and a couple of his colleagues, starting in Philadelphia, and then later they did this again at Harvard in a more extensive way, they collected baby teeth from kids and measured the levels of lead in their teeth. And they ultimately showed an association between lower IQs, behavioral problems, and higher levels of lead in the blood. And his research showed that even small amounts of lead, amounts that nobody at the time thought were really a problem, could have long-lasting health effects.
So after decades and decades of using lead and not really understanding the consequences, Needleman suddenly has this research. How were his ideas accepted at the time?
There was a lot of controversy over his research. Among lead researchers, his findings were generally accepted, but the lead industry really came up against him. And the lead industry also funded other scientists who questioned Needleman's research. The lead industry had an incentive to disagree with his findings, and they called them into question, saying that he had misrepresented them. It kind of comes down to this question of epidemiological research and just the field of epidemiology. It's the study of disease, right? So you can't just put a child in a room and feed them lead and watch them for 10 years and see what happens, because that's unethical. So you have to look at a community and say, okay, you know, these kids live here and here's what their blood lead level was in the womb, you know, looking at their umbilical cord. And then we measure it over this number of years and we track where they live and we track their IQ. And then you do that with a whole bunch of kids and you can show associations. And so people were calling his research into question, saying, well, you know, there may be associations, but you can't prove that lead is the reason that their IQs are lower. Maybe their IQs are lower because their parents' IQs are lower, or maybe their IQs are lower because they don't go to a good school. Researchers try to control for those things, but basically they were saying he didn't control for those things enough. He was under investigation by the University of Pittsburgh. He was cleared of any scientific misconduct and vindicated. You know, he won the Heinz Award in 1995. People now think of him for the most part as, I guess, a visionary.
Are Needleman's ideas still being used today when we talk about lead poisoning and lead levels?
Yeah, that's the so his research really laid the foundation for the future of lead research. So the CDC came out with new guidelines in 2012 in which they said that there's no level of lead in the blood that's known to be safe. So they previously had this threshold that they called, you know, the blood lead level of concern. And this is a little technical, but it's 10 micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood. It was kind of arbitrary. And they would say, you know, if a kid has more than that amount of lead in their blood, then we should be concerned. And so now they're saying any amount of lead in the blood is concerning. They also lowered the threshold to 5. That's just based on, you know, what the majority of kids, the threshold that the majority of kids in the country fall under. And they're changing their approach because basically they're saying any amount of lead can cause permanent effects on a child's IQ, their ability to learn. And so doctors and public health officials should always be trying to do better and to make sure that there's no more lead in the environment because it's not safe. And, you know, ultimately, this is a preventable health problem.
If you are just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Eleanor Klibanoff, and we're discussing the legacy of lead in Pennsylvania cities. You've just heard from Marielle Segura on the history of lead poisoning. She says we've known about the dangers of lead to children since the 1970s, but the hazards are still out there. For Keystone Crossroads, Irina Zhurov and I have been reporting on lead pipes and lead paint in Pennsylvania cities. Irina joins us now to discuss those potential hazards and what it would take to remediate them once and for all. Irina, just how prevalent is lead in Pennsylvania's drinking water infrastructure?
It's really widespread. So a lot of the cities in Pennsylvania are older cities, as you know, and lead was used kind of in the 1800s and early 1900s. So when a lot of these cities were growing, that's when lead was in use, and so many of those cities installed lead. But it was not installed in the main waterways, which would have been the city's responsibility, but rather in the service lines. And those are the lines that go from the mains, which run down a street, to the individual houses or buildings. So those are the majority of lines that are actually lead, and there's a lot of them, but no one knows exactly how much.
Why was lead so widely used for piping?
So back then, lead was seen as this malleable, long-lasting, amazing material, whereas other materials, you know, when you buried them in the ground, they would either crack or break in parts and sprout leaks. Lead did not do that. So what they did is it was in a big roll, and they would roll out this pipe, and then they would bury it in the ground, and as the ground settled and shifted, the pipe, because it was soft, would move with it instead of cracking or breaking. So it was seen really as a good investment. It was slightly more expensive than other materials available at the time, but it lasted way, way longer, 100 years. You know, a lot of these lead pipes are that old right now, and they're still functioning, for the most part, pretty well. So it was just seen as a good investment, as a good material that the engineers like to work with.
There were even some cities that required the use of lead pipes. How did that happen?
Yeah, so historically, a lot of the plumbing codes, they weren't called plumbing codes back then, but a lot of the rules that, you know, set what kinds of plumbing were allowed were decided at a local level. So the municipality itself would be saying, you know, use this material, but not that one. And so whoever the person making those decisions would decide, let's use lead or let's not use lead for whatever reason. You know, I mentioned before that a lot of engineers preferred lead because it lasted a long time. So a lot of the engineers actually put out an ordinance that said, if you are building a house in, for example, Philadelphia, then you have to use lead. And so a lot of cities did have rules like that on the book. In Philadelphia, there were ordinances like that. At least in 1916, maybe earlier, other cities had laws like that as well.
But once the dangers of lead were identified, did lead go away as a material that we used in piping and solder?
When there was some consensus from public health officials that maybe lead wasn't the best material for infrastructure that carried water to people's homes, the lead industry actually started lobbying against changes away from lead. And they actually sent representatives to cities all over the U.S. And those representatives would try to convince the cities or, you know, whoever happened to be the one making that rule in the city that sticking with lead is a good idea. And so in some cases, they were able to convince cities that had already moved away from lead to go back to it. Plumbing unions had a lot to do with this. Working with lead takes a lot of skill. And if, you know, there was competition from like handymen who would go around and say, I'll install your pipe, but the plumbers would say, no, like lead is the best material and only the plumbers can work with this because we're the only ones skillful enough to do it. So they had a lot of inherent interest in this, and they helped lobby for the use of lead as well. It was almost kind of insurance for their jobs. So there was a lot of interest in keeping lead in place. You know, the Lead Industries Association, which was the lobbying group, they did that work all the way into the 70s.
The EPA banned the use of lead in pipes and solder in 1986. Was that when most cities stopped using it?
It really depends where. So in some respects, it was an organic evolution away from lead. Things like copper came along, and that was seen as, you know, a better material to use. But when that started happening really varies. For example, in Philadelphia, they consider the 1950s as the cutoff point after which lead was not really used. In a lot of cities nationwide, that cutoff point is the 1930s. That's what they used to say, you know, any house built after that probably doesn't have lead. In Chicago, plumbers unions were pushing for lead in 1986. Even as this law was being passed, they were pushing for the use of lead. So it just really depends on both the leadership in the city, what they were using as their plumbing codes, kind of what the rules locally were.
There have been some calls in Flint and beyond to replace all the lead pipes. What would that actually entail?
So for one, research. You know, I mentioned that most of the lead lines are service lines. That's the lines that go from the water main to the individual buildings. The thing is, nobody really knows which service lines in any particular city are lead. There's just the mapping for that hasn't really happened. The utilities, some of them have a better idea maybe than others, but there is no sort of definitive document that shows leadership where those lead lines are. So first of all, they'd have to figure that out. The other thing is you'd have to decide what to get rid of. There's lead in the pipes, there's lead in the solder, there's lead in some older fixtures, there's lead in the service lines and the indoor plumbing. Also, the rule from the law from 1986 that banned lead initially, it didn't actually ban it completely. It still allowed pipes with up to 8% of lead content in them. So you also have to decide, do you remove anything at all that has any lead at all in it? Or do you just remove the, you know, purely lead pipes or whatnot? So you have to decide that. Then you have to have buy-in from homeowners because they're the ones that often own the service line or at least a part of the service line. And it can cost thousands of dollars to remove that. It's going to be very hard to convince homeowners to drop thousands of dollars to replace lines that could be working just fine. Cities have done it. Madison, Wisconsin is one example. And they were successful, at least in part, because they also offered reimbursements to those homeowners. So thinking about funding is another piece of that.
Water utilities have to test for lead, and the majority of them pass. What do those results actually mean?
So under the lead and copper rule, the EPA requires that all utilities test for lead levels in the water. But what they're actually looking for is if that specific utility's anti-corrosion plan is working. So basically, lead gets in your water when your lead pipe corrodes. And most utilities have some sort of program in place that keeps that corrosion to a minimum. It's the anti-corrosion plan. So what the testing does is it looks, is that anti-corrosion plan working or are the pipes continuing to corrode from the water when the water passes through them? So the tests don't actually tell you what percentage of homes have elevated levels. What they're designed to tell you the test results is whether the anti-corrosion plan is working.
In Pennsylvania, lead pipes are one concern, but I've actually been reporting on lead paint, which is another widespread issue here in the Commonwealth.
So how do children get lead poisoning from lead paint?
So lead paint was banned in 1978, but since then, Pennsylvania has only refreshed about 30% of our housing stock. So 70% of homes in Pennsylvania likely have lead paint somewhere on their walls. It's probably buried under layers of non-lead paint. But when that paint starts to chip or starts to peel, children can ingest the paint, and that causes lead poisoning. That's even just the paint dust. Anytime you close a window or slam a door and the paint chips or paint dust gets released into the air, a child can consume that, and the CDC says there's no safe level of lead for a child to ingest. So, for example, rates of lead poisoning tend to go up in the spring because, you know, people open their windows for the first time, the breeze is blowing the dust around, kids are standing at the windows, putting their hands in their mouths, and they're ingesting lead paint and poisoning themselves.
Who is most affected by lead paint poisoning?
The biggest category is children under the age of 6 or 7, depending on the research you're looking at, have their development severely stunted by consuming lead paint or suffering from lead poisoning. And the symptoms often don't emerge until later, but they tend to look like ADD or dyslexia, hyperactivity. Kids who have lead poisoning, you know, they have lower IQ scores, do worse on neurological tests, tend to have poor results in school and issues like that. So one of the ironies of lead paint is that it tastes very, very sweet. So kids who start peeling at paint or start eating peeling paint are often drawn back to it again and again and eat more and more of it. Kids, you see their lead levels escalate very quickly, particularly if it isn't caught or identified early on. And then lead paint poisoning also disproportionately affects low-income children. You know, some of that is because they tend to live in older homes that are less well-maintained, so more likely to have that chipping or peeling paint. But also diet affects lead poisoning rates. So children who are eating high-fat, greasy foods, the lead sticks in their system longer than children who are eating a more balanced diet with plenty of greens and vitamins and minerals.
If lead paint was banned in 1978, why is this still a problem today?
So there are a few reasons. For one thing, in Pennsylvania, we don't always know where the lead paint is. Pennsylvania is not a mandatory testing state. So in some states like Connecticut, every child gets tested at age 1 and 2. In Pennsylvania in 2014, only 14% of children under the age of 6 were tested for lead. And 9% of those children were identified as having lead in their system. So we just don't know if that other 86% of children, if they're living in homes with a lead hazard or not. So the good news about that testing data is that in all likelihood, the most vulnerable children are getting tested. Families who receive Medicaid, their children receive a mandatory battery of tests at age 1 and 2. So they are getting tested for lead. So children from low-income families who are perhaps more likely to live in a home with a lead hazard are more likely to get tested as well. Pennsylvania is considering, in the wake of what's been happening in Flint, they're considering changes to that policy, perhaps making Pennsylvania a mandatory testing state. The downsides are it is pretty expensive and would require state funding, but it would give health officials a more complete picture of where all the lead is in Pennsylvania. But once we find out where the lead paint is, there's still another issue because getting rid of lead paint is really, really expensive. You know, it's not just painting over it. To actually remediate the lead in your home, you either have to have a certified lead abatement contractor remove it, or often what they recommend is adding a new layer of drywall on top of that layer, basically permanently encapsulating it so that it's no longer a hazard. That can cost in the tens of thousands of dollars. And that's just not something that every low-income family, or really any family, can afford. So I spoke to Vicki Kistler, who's the executive director of the Allentown Department of Health, and she told me about what those challenges look like on the ground in a city like Allentown.
We have had landlords shutter up the building. The lead abatement could actually be more costly than the value of the property. We have had homeowners sell their home. They can't do the abatement, and then they have to disclose that it has lead, so it would be difficult to resell it.
Without outside assistance or funding, it's just not likely that a family or a landlord can afford to do that sort of remediation work on their own, or that they're going to.
So who should pay for that remediation then? Where does the funding come from?
Right, so that's sort of the question. Nationally, the whole lead issue is funded a little haphazardly. You've got a lot of different organizations like the EPA, the CDC, HUD, all provide some funding, and then the state provides some funding, and then cities provide their own funding. It's really a piecemeal system. Right now, Pennsylvania has no outside grant funding to pay for really anything to do with lead. They used to receive funding from a lot of different sources. Right now, the state puts $2 million a year towards lead issues, and that's mostly paying for education, a hotline, a team of community health nurses who help families with temporary solutions, you know, so that they can basically get the kid past the age of six, past those crucial developmental years without being poisoned by lead. So Vicki Kistler, who's from the Allentown Department of Health, said those interim measures often work, and that's usually what the city ends up doing unless a child's lead levels are really extreme.
So we actually deliver them cleaning supplies. We tell the parent to wash the child's hands more frequently, wash the toys, keep the floors and windowsills clean, and we work with that family and the pediatrician to try to implement that plan of action and then retest and see if the levels go down.
The kid, you know, might not suffer from lead poisoning, but the paint remains on the walls. It's just covered up until the next family moves in. You start to see that paint chipping again, and the same thing repeats over and over again. So that's part of the reason why we have gone 40 years without completely removing the lead paint hazard. There are these temporary steps that can help and that can solve the problem in that moment, but we continue to have kids who suffer from lead poisoning year after year after year.
There have been some lawsuits against the paint companies. Is that a source of funding?
So in 2008, the state of Rhode Island sued the paint companies who were responsible for creating lead paint, and they were awarded $4 billion to pay for lead remediation. So that's the smallest state in the nation being awarded that much money. Many people said, you know, that would effectively knock out the lead paint problem in Rhode Island. So that case was struck down on appeal, and the judge saying that children who might be harmed in the future or might be poisoned by lead in the future had no standing in court. Basically, we had to wait until children had been poisoned to then come back and sue on their behalf. So a similar case has been brought in California, and by a handful of cities in California who joined together and sued the lead paint companies. They were awarded $1.2 billion. That case is also under appeal right now, but if the judge rules that the paint companies have to pay for that, we would set a precedent for other states to try the same. States like Pennsylvania, where a massive percentage of homes were built before that 1978 lead paint ban. Thanks to Keystone Crossroads reporters Irina Zhurov and Mariel Segura for joining us today on Take Note. Keystone Crossroads is a public radio collaboration focusing on the challenges and solutions facing Pennsylvania's cities. To see all of our coverage on the lead issue, go to keystonecrossroads.org/lead. And to hear other interviews in the Take Note series, check the link on our website, wpsu.org/take note. For WPSU, I'm Eleanor Klibanoff.